My name is Penny. Recently, the New York Times published strange headlines from the past issues of their papers. And there was one there that just hit me right for today. Penelope Joyful, after long wait. I thought, after a year of joyful working on this with two wonderful co-chairmen, it just seemed to be the ideal thing to open with. Then the October issue of our Connecticut Lifeline came out, and that helped me too to get up here today, for it stated, start your diet with Lois's Luncheon. It's sure to be the greatest gain of your life. I know you're aware of this, but most of you are here today because of one person. Can you imagine how we'd all probably be sitting at home feeling miserable if one person had not had an inspiring idea? It was our dear Lois's idea that started Al-Anon for friends and families of alcoholics. The idea that we can help ourselves. That was a break for the alcoholic, wasn't it? She realized that we need not live our lives totally dependent upon that of the alcoholic, whether drunk or sober. We can live a full, happy life filled with purpose. She is an example and an inspiration to all of us in her loving generosity, her youthfulness, openness, and flexibility of mind, her forthright and deep spiritual strength. Her life of dedication is a perfect example of the saying, it is better to serve than to be served. I am privileged to introduce to you the founder of Al-Anon, our dear Lois.
Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Lois, and I'm an Al-Anon. But I think I'm also an AA, because I was around at the very early days, and that was my first love. But I want to first thank you all for this wonderful luncheon we are having here together. For all your kindness to me and your gratitude, and for this very happy gathering to see all your smiling faces is a great joy. And there really never, I think, in this world is anything like the getting together of AAs and Al-Anons. There's something here in a meeting together that we never can get any other way, I think. Something special when we all gather together and enjoy each other and share our love and gratitude. And I want to thank the committee for all their graciousness to me and the beautiful flowers and all their kindness. And I also want to contradict Penny in saying that all so many wonderful things started with me. That isn't true at all. And as I tell my story, which I will do, I think you'll see that it wasn't really anything to do with me except that I happened to be the first link in a chain. Every other member in a chain is just as important as the first member. It just happened to be me that was in that position. When Bill and I were engaged, I was very, very proud of him because he never touched alcohol. I hadn't any particular fear of alcohol because there was nobody in my family that drank too much. We always had wine or liqueurs on the table on Sunday. But nobody ever seemed to take too much. But I knew Bill was afraid of it. And he had been warned by his family that he must not touch a drop of liquor, because if he did, he might get into the same kind of trouble that his father and his grandfather before him did. So for some reason, he believed them. And he stayed away from alcohol in all his boyhood and until he was married. Getting married must have been what broke him over. He'd go to the bars and saloons with the boys, and he'd take ginger ale or sarsaparilla or something, root beer, while they took beer. And I thought he was so very strong-willed. But then after we married and lived in New Bedford, Massachusetts, we went to several parties. There was quite a little bit of money and social life there in New Bedford, Massachusetts. That was where Bill was stationed, at Fort Rodman. And this was during the First World War. First World War is what I'm trying to say. And the socialites in the town used to invite the young army officers on the post to parties. Thank you. And the first one that I went to as a bride, I didn't see Bill around. And some of the other officers that I'd met came to me and said, "We've just taken Bill home and we put him to bed." And then they took me home, and there was Bill in bed with a bucket at his head. And I was really terribly shocked and surprised, but I didn't think it was going to be anything very serious. And Bill didn't drink really too much except when we had a party, but he always got drunk. He never took a few drinks. He always drank until he was laid out stiff. But I thought that I'd be able to change him. I thought living with me would be so inspirational that he wouldn't need any artificial stimulant. But things got worse and worse and worse. And as time went on, and we had no children, my one purpose in life was to help Bill become sober. And as you all know, my one purpose didn't succeed. Years and years went by, and Bill got worse and worse. And he had episode after episode until one day, 17 years after we'd been married, and after I had tried with everything within me to help him, he finally did get sober. But it was not through me. It was not my inspiration that sobered Bill up. A friend came to him, bright-eyed and cherry-faced, who had usually been half squished with liquor when he came to New York. And this friend he'd known for many years, and they'd had many drunken episodes together. But now he was clear-eyed, as I said. And he said he'd found a release from alcohol. And he told Bill about it, and Bill was very much interested. We had tried everything together, Bill and I. Towards the end of Bill's drinking, he had been so hopeless about himself that he'd asked me to help him, and we'd tried to do everything together that we could think of to stop his drinking, but nothing had worked. But this friend said that he was not on the wagon. He was not fighting alcohol. The problem had been taken from him. He was released from the problem. And as I say, Bill was terribly struck by this, because he had wanted with his own very soul to stop drinking, but he hadn't been able to. So he went to the hospital to try to get his thinking clear up his thinking, so that he could try to understand a little what had happened to this friend. And when he was at the hospital, he had this wonderful experience that you probably read about in the big book. And he, too, was released from alcohol. At first, when he went to the hospital, I was upset about it. He'd left me a note. He hadn't consulted with me. I had become the chief cook and bottle washer in the family, because Bill has gotten so he wasn't able to make any decisions or to earn any money to speak of. And I'd had to be nurse and mother and caretaker and breadwinner. So I thought I should be asked about making any decision about going to a hospital that required money, especially. But when I did go to see him, I knew something terrific had happened. He was a different man, a light in his eyes was most revealing. And since that moment, I never really had any doubt about his having found what he was looking for. So, after he got out of the hospital, he was so excited about this wonderful thing that had happened to him that he thought, well, this could happen to other people. Why not sober up all the drunks of the world? Bill never did anything by halves. So he set out and began bringing them all to Clinton Street where we lived. And I think he must have gotten at least half of them, brought half of them to the house, because we had them living on all floors of the house that belonged to my father where we were living. And they were in all stages of sobriety. Well, I was really terribly moved and excited about this wonderful thing. But after a while, I didn't seem to be quite as happy as I thought I ought to be. And one day, Bill said to me, "Lois, let's hurry up and go to the meetings." We were going to Oxford Group meetings then. Ebby, the friend that had come to Bill and told him about his release, belonged to the Oxford Group. And we'd gone to those meetings together. And I'd gone along with Bill because that's what a good wife does, goes along with her husband. But I hadn't gone for my own benefit. The Oxford Group was a spiritual program, and they were trying to help by changing individual lives. And I didn't think I needed to be changed. I knew Bill needed to keep up going to these meetings, but I didn't need to. I'd had a good bringing up. I'd had a lovely, loving family and a good religious training as a child. And I didn't see any need that I needed any changing. I loved Bill, and I thought that that was all that was necessary. So when Bill said, "Hurry up, let's get ready and go to the meeting," I had a shoe in my hand, and I took that shoe and I threw it just as hard as I could, and I said, "Darn your old meetings. This surprised me even more than it did Bill." And I started wondering about myself for the first time. I started trying to think of my relationship to Bill and to my fellow man and to my God. I'd taken myself for granted before. And now I began, as I say, to think and wonder, why had I lost my temper over such a simple thing? There must be something wrong somewhere. And what was it? And by degrees, I saw that I was terribly, deeply hurt that somebody else had come along and talked with Bill for just a few minutes And Bill's whole life was changed. Whereas I had tried our whole 17 years together and have not succeeded. Also, Bill and I had been very companionable because he was alcoholic. We had stayed away from all our friends and our families. We'd been thrown on each other entirely. We relied completely on each other for everything. And now I had no companionship with him. He was off in the highways and byways collecting drugs. And I wasn't needed anymore. Before that, I had been terribly needed. I was the staff of the family. But now, I didn't know just where I stood or what I was supposed to be doing. I knew I was working, I had a job, and I had a house full of drunks to look after. But Bill was just as loving and devoted as ever, but he didn't need me the way he had before. And I guess we all want to be needed. So after the long years of thinking about this, I really have seen that I had a lot of resentment against all these drunks that were coming in. Although I liked them all, you can't help but liking them. And they were, because we didn't have them very often. Once in a while we had them when they were drunk, but mostly they were just in the kind of a sad sap stage afterwards. So, as I said, it has taken me many, many years to really understand myself and to see how much I rationalized. And after a while, Bill's group of drugs began to grow. And he went out to Akron and met Bob Smith, Dr. Bob. And the groups began out there to grow. Because they were groups out there, really, before there were groups in New York. We just had a few odd drugs around. But the groups began to start out there. And then they began growing all over the country, really very, very fast. It was, I think, in 1950, which was quite a number of years after this. It was 34 that Bill sobered up. And AA had developed and grown. And in 1950, he had thought that a conference of delegates was a very necessary thing for AA. And he went around the country trying to get the opinion of the groups and of the AAs everywhere in this United States and Canada to see what their feeling about the matter was. And to his surprise, he found that there were quite a number of groups of the families of alcoholics. You see, in the very beginning, when there was no literature, AA literature, you had to travel, you had to talk face to face with a new prospect. There was no literature to send through the mail to start a group. It had to be all done by word of mouth. So there was a lot of traveling. And when we had traveled around, Bill had talked with the alcoholics and I had talked with the families. And I told them about my experience, how I had found that I too needed to live by the same 12 steps as Bill did. So, what with that start and the feeling, the same spontaneous feeling that I had that I needed to start, other people in other groups had that same feeling too. So these groups of families of alcoholics had been going on for quite some time. And some of them were for just hanging up curtains in the clubhouse or putting on coffee at a meeting. But a few of them were for the for their own spiritual development. And when he came back from this trip around the country, he told me about it. And he said that he thought they should have a central office, a service office, that could unite them and be a place where people could write for information, just as the alcoholics had a service office. Well, that seemed like a good idea, but I was so interested in having a home of my own, which we hadn't had for many years during the early periods of AA, that I didn't think I wanted to do it at first. And then I began to think about it and think about the really great need for such a thing. And then, of course, I became more and more enthusiastic every minute. And I got a friend of mine who lived in the neighborhood, and Bigham, to help me. And we started upstairs, and we wrote to the AA office and asked them if they had any inquiries from the families of alcoholics. And to our surprise, they had 87 names of people that had written in to the AA office and wanted to register there. But of course, AA was for alcoholics only and had nothing special to give the families of alcoholics. So they had just wrote them a pleasant responding letter and kept their names. They handed us over those 87 names. And Anne and I wrote to them. They were mostly groups, but one or two were just lone members. And to our surprise, we got 49 answers, which was very good. The 49 groups said that they would like to form a fellowship. They would like to have a service office of their own, and that they would like the name Al-Anon Family Groups. There was one that didn't, just one out of the 49 that didn't want to join us. AA has always been very, very cooperative and very helpful to Al-Anon. They let us have the upstairs room in their New York clubhouse for a very low rent, and they've always been very considerate and helpful. So we began to get volunteers for our new service office in down in New York on West 24th Street. And Al-Anon, from that beginning, has grown to, in a remarkable way, to really tremendous size. At least it seems that way to one who saw it in the very early days. And now there are, I believe, 13,000 groups of Al-Anon in 70 countries. And Al-Anon has been translated, Al-Anon literature. We have 6 hardcover books, and our books have been translated into 8 different languages. So that's the story of the growth of Al-Anon, at least my side of it, part of it. And you look around and see all the people here and all the happiness. And it just is a most inspiring and thrilling thing for me to be here with you. And I thank you all so much.
We end with the Lord's Prayer, please. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation,
take them to it.